Welcome to Worlds Apart. A decade ago, when historians were revisiting the origins of the First World War, the term sleepwalking became very trendy in describing how divergent factors and self-serving actors tangled together to produce one of the biggest catastrophes in human history. As the world enters yet another period of strife, are we still somnambulating, or are we being deliberately led into an abyss? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Benjamin Abelov, author of How the West Brought War to Ukraine. Mr. Abelov, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, the title of your book, How the West Brought War to Ukraine, is quite self-explanatory and unambiguous. But the contrarian in me wants to challenge it immediately, because after all, it was Russia that launched this military operation on the Ukrainian soil. And this is something that both decision makers and opinion shapers in the West are trying to frame as an act of aggression, a totally unprovoked act of aggression that goes against international law. And I have to say there is some validity to this argument. Why do you think it was the West that was the main driving force behind this conflict?
One of the points I make in the book is to try to distinguish between what I refer to as proximal causes, the causes that immediately preceded a war, and the deeper causes that can extend back in history. There's no natural starting point for when one tries to establish a sequence of events. So that while I make clear that the immediate cause of the war was Mr. Putin decided to launch the war, he and his military staff, or whoever else in the Kremlin, was intimately involved in the decision. And in that sense, they bear responsibility for initiating the war. And if the war could have been stopped and prevented at that point, then he bears responsibility. And of course, the Russians bear responsibility for how the war is being carried out. What I'm focusing on in the book more is not so much the proximal causes, but I refer to as the distal causes, the causes that extend further back in time, that are now kind of hidden from sight, that may have been on the newspaper papers, on the pages of the newspapers years ago, and have been forgotten, mm-hmm. or they may never have been on the pages of the papers at all. So I'm focusing mostly on the distal causes and the causes leading up to the current moment.
And you know, your book reminded me a bit this 2012 bestseller by Christopher Clark on the origins of the First World War, the Sleepwalkers. And one of the reasons that book was so popular is because he tried to break with the old paradigm of assigning a culprit and focusing on the who and the why. And instead, he was more interested in the structural dynamics of swelling animosity. When you observe the way the events develop on both sides of the Atlantic, do you think decision makers are cognizant of how dangerous it could be, and perhaps of the historic lessons of the previous conflicts?
Yeah, that's a great way of framing it with sleepwalking. I would make just a couple of points. First, I think I can't speak for the inner mind of the leaders, but just going from what statements I see being made publicly on both sides, I'm sure there's some cognizance of the threat of nuclear war and the danger of this getting out of control. I don't think there's enough. And that's my fear, or one of the fears connected with this conflict. I'll also just riff for a moment on your comment about World War I. I think very often in the West, and you know, different people have different opinions, but I think the mainstream view that's coming out of Washington and in the media is trying to impose the model of World War II, a sort of Hitler-like expansionist. And unfortunately, there are even some who refer to Mr. Putin as the new Hitler or whatever. And this is, I would call, shoehorning a past event into a current event into a past model. Some people refer to it as a Procrustean bed. I think that the model that people is that's actually more appropriate and the greater concern is the model of World War I, where an uncontrolled arms race between, as is usually described, and there's complications to this, but an uncontrolled arms race between Britain and Germany through a series of events and a series of uncontrollable circumstances, contingencies, led to the outbreak of a war that was a catastrophe. And I think there's a great danger that we may run into that kind of problem now. And it's that World War I model that needs to be attended to closely in the West and also in Russia, of course.
World War I helped the United States to accumulate economic potential. And there are lots of people, not lots, but some analysts here in Moscow who believe that the Americans are interested in having another global conflict as a way of overcoming the multiplicity of crises that we are facing right now, the crisis of capitalism, the crisis of global governance, ecological crisis, what have you. And I would claim that there are some historical precedents of that. I mean, Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, clearly demonstrates how the capitalist aims could be served by the sanctioned use of state violence. Ultimately, is this a conflict about values, as the Biden administration claims, or is it a conflict about resources and, you know, getting preferential and keeping preferential conditions that the United States has accumulated as a hegemon?
Yeah, I don't see this conflict as being won over values. That's not to say that there might not be differences in values between, elements of the U.S. population or elements of the U.S. leadership and elements of the Russian population and Russian leadership. There may well be some differences, but I don't see this conflict as having to do with that. I see this primarily as frankly, a proxy war on Russia's border that is being pursued by the U.S. and the NATO powers. I think that it's not to say that it's all poorly intentioned. I think there are probably a range of motivations. Some people probably are not seeing clearly. Some people are probably very well intentioned, but are imposing outdated models and incorrect models in their interpretation of events. But I think the geostrategic thing is very central. There are certainly people and elements in the U.S. elites that do want to weaken Russia. You know, this whole question of a unipolar world, there is concern about that. There's the Wolfowitz doctrine, et cetera, et cetera. I don't see that that's actually... I don't like what's going on with respect to that. As far as the financial and the monetary issues, you know, there certainly are questions built into the background about the role of the U.S. dollar as the international reserve currency. There's questions, of course, about how international markets work. To the extent to which I've really thought about the financial elements of this is, I do believe there's actually much truth to the concern about the military-industrial complex. I'm sure your viewers are aware that this is a term that originally coined and popularized by President Eisenhower, who was a five-star World War II general and hero. And in his farewell address to the American public, his final televised address, he warned the American public of the combination of military bureaucratic power and financial interest of the arms industry. And in fact, he even seemed like he was going to go so far as to bring in the question of financial conflicts of interest within Congress, but was told, Mr. President, you can't go so far. So I think that there are conflicts, financial conflicts of interest and power conflicts of interest that have played some role in motivating the Western stances towards what's happening.
In your book, you make the point that for 200 years of the U.S.'s defense policy, it was based, if not on respect, then at least paying some attention to the opponent's red lines or security sensibilities, and that when it came to Russia, the United States and NATO disregarded this principle. Question number one, do you think they made that decision deliberately? Was it a conscious choice? And why would they do that, given that, again, Russia is not some third world country? It has nuclear weapons. It has a strong army. It has multiple resources. What do you think would be the ultimate goal of what they would be trying to achieve if they had their dreams fulfilled?
Yeah. Let me just back up one step before I try to respond to that, and hopefully I won't lose the thread of your actual question as I do this. I just want to make a little clearer the notion of the geography and the red lines and the question of, I refer to in the book, the Monroe Doctrine. This is a doctrine, of course, it wasn't referred to as a doctrine initially, but it's based on a statement by then President Monroe in 1823. That really at that time had to do with colonialism, but ultimately has been interpreted in different ways, having to do with the idea that a foreign power that places a potential opponent, that places military forces anywhere near U.S. borders, anywhere in the Western Hemisphere even, knows it is crossing a red line. One could only imagine what would happen if, for instance, Russia had formed an alliance with Canada or with Mexico.
Or with Cuba, is it that attempted to do?
Or even Cuba, right, which is, right, Cuba, right, of course. And even that's further away than right on the border. And we could see during the Cuban Missile Crisis how aggressively the U.S. responded, or I don't want to say regressively, it could be defensively, but how, what sort of intense fears of attack that aroused on the part of the United States.
The United States recognized it as its legitimate security interest, and I think everybody else, including the Soviets, actually understood it. That's why they reached a settlement.
Yeah. I think that's very true. So, you know, there's a chapter in my book where I call putting the shoe on the other foot, by which I mean to say, how would the U.S. respond if Russia or China had done something sort of equivalent, forming an alliance with Canada and Mexico? And we saw what happened, even with respect to Cuba off the coast. How about if it was right on the border, as Ukraine or Georgia or other places are right on Russia's border? So I think it's very important to try to
treat your opponent as your moral equal. That's what you're trying to say. But the United States clearly doesn't see us as equals.
I think there's some truth to that among many people in Washington. I think another way to look at it also is there's the writer and blogger Robert Wright, who uses the term cognitive empathy. And by that, what he means is sort of your ability to mentally or psychologically transpose yourself into the shoes of the other person. And I would say, you know, I think there are people who you could say they have a very they have a view of Russia as intrinsically evil and they hate. There certainly are people like that. But I think there are probably others who I would simply say they lack cognitive empathy, by which I mean an inability to transpose themselves into the position of the other side and see how they would feel, or even to reverse the picture and see how they would feel if the other side did the same thing to them.
Absolutely, especially if the American own security doctrine doesn't allow for that. I mean, if you actually look at the American strategic documents, there is no space for empathy of any kind. There is a simple statement of hegemony that needs to be protected. But Mr. Abelov, let's continue this fascinating conversation after a short break that we have to take right now. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Benjamin Abelov, author of How the West Brought War to Ukraine. Mr. Abelov, we began talking before the break about how the lessons of the World War I may be relevant in considering this swelling crisis. But I think there are also many firsts that we haven't seen. And one of them would be, as far as I would claim, is the first, the explosion at the Nord Stream pipeline, the act of industrial terrorism, something like this never happened before, even during the Cold War. And also the nuclear threat. I'm sure you follow I know that you have a keen interest in nuclear affairs. You used to lobby Congress on nuclear issues. And we all know that there is a huge nuclear station right in the middle of this war zone that is at least according to the Russian narrative, is being constantly shelled by Ukraine. So let's consider this. First of all, I want to ask for your reactions on the explosions at the Nord Stream pipeline, because regardless of who is to blame, I think it really shifts the frame, because it introduces a new norm that one side can attack the industrial infrastructure. And second of all, it also shows that in the area of NATO naval control, no infrastructure is safe and could be, in fact, vulnerable to industrial terrorism.
Well, I have many things to say about this. I'll try to keep it very brief, and you'll keep me on track if I go too long on one thing. Yeah, just you throw a rock at me. First, obviously, this is an extremely dangerous movement. I'm not quite sure I'll call it escalation, but let's call it a movement of conflict into another sphere, whether this was carried out by Russia, by the United States, by other NATO powers. I don't think anyone knows for sure yet, although I have an opinion of what I think is most likely. So as a starting point, I want to say that I think this is very dangerous, and it could lead to a type of sort of escalation of attacks on infrastructure outside of the current battlefield. Mm-hmm. And this, there's no end to this, where this could go. Number two, I want to make a comment about the reasons why I think more attention needs to be paid to the possibility in the West that the United States is actually behind this. And then finally, I want to comment on something about the Western media, which I've been extremely disappointed in.
Okay, so let's take it one by one. Why do you think the United States may have some associations with that, apart from Secretary of State Anthony Blinken presenting that as a great opportunity?
Yeah. Well, I think the things that are most persuasive to me are statements made by both President Biden and by the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Victoria Nuland. Both of them, in the period before the war started, but when Russia was already massing on the border, both of them stated explicitly that the U.S., I have the actual quotations, I'll actually read them, because I don't want to rely on what's the paper. I went back to the video, which anyone can find online, just search Mr. Biden, Nord Stream 2, we will end this pipeline. Mm-hmm. Mr. Biden stated explicitly, this was made on February 7th at a press conference with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz on the podium with him. If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will no longer be a Nord Stream 2. We will bring it to an end. And then a member of the press said, how will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within German control? And Mr. Biden responded in a very knowing tone, I promise you, we'll be able to do it. In a separate presentation, Victoria Nuland, the Undersecretary of State, stated, if Russia invades Ukraine, one way or another, Nord Stream 2 will not move forward. I think that those statements alone, they do not prove that the U.S. did it. In an ultimate sense, I'm withholding any judgment with certainty. Mm-hmm. But in medicine, there's something called prior probability. You look at the full constellation of data that's available before you undertake a definitive diagnostic test. And you say, how likely is it that one party or another? And I would say that these statements were explicit statements about what would happen if Russia invaded. And then Russia invaded, and then this did happen. I would say this places a high prior probability that the United States was behind this. Does not prove it, and I remain open to new evidence. But I think there should be much more concern than there is that this is what happened.
But I think I need to make an important clarification for our viewers that Mr. Biden made that statement about Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the new pipeline that Russia constructed, whereas the explosions took place at the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, which still is pretty much still the same, because that pipeline was intended and was intended to bring natural gas to Germany as well as to many other countries. Now, the Americans like to talk about the solidity of the alliances, particularly their alliances with Europe. And it's pretty clear to anyone who knows anything about how industry operates that German economy, to a large extent, and many other European economies were built on the access to affordable Russian energy sources. That's the very foundation, or one of the foundations, of European prosperity. If we take that hypothesis that the United States was behind it one way or another, or that it even sanctioned it, that it approves of it, which, you know, Anthony Blinken said it explicitly that it's a great opportunity, what do you think would be, what do you think that would say about the American attitude towards it, its European allies? Do you think they will be able to function to maintain their industrial capacity without having energy?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just comment briefly on your point about Nord Stream 1 versus Nord Stream 2. And I think that's an excellent point, one that I've not been focusing on. I do want to make what I think may be one small correction, unless there's some new news today. My understanding was that, at least as of yesterday, there were a total of 3 explosions affecting both pipelines. Mm-hmm. However, each pipeline has two, is a double pipeline. Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that both of the pipelines of the duplex pipeline in Nord Stream 1 were damaged, and one of the two in Nord Stream 2 were damaged. Yeah. My suspicion is that the other one, that whoever was planning this actually intended to hit all 4, but things get complicated at 250 feet below the ocean surface. So I think that is a valid point, though, that you're raising, and perhaps it should make one a little bit less certain, or a little bit less confident, that it was the U.S., and maybe it takes a little bit of pressure away off the statements of Biden and Nuland. What does it say about the relationships about if the U.S. did, in fact, carry this out? And I want to get to the press also. Maybe you can focus my question after that. But what does this say about the relationship? If this happens, certainly the United States has long been opposed to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Certainly some people have pointed out that this, if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, or if the Nord Stream 1 also stopped operating, that this would create tremendous markets, new markets for liquefied natural gas coming from the United States. Certainly there could be influences along those lines. I am not quite so mercenary and cynical in my interpretation there. I think, again, that some of this may have come from what were, among some people at least, you know, well-intentioned, that they, correctly or wrong, correctly or incorrectly, had a deep fear of Russia and did not want a closer alliance between Russia and Germany. And they saw the supply of natural gas as an important element of that. And one of the motivations that one could posit would be, you could almost call it a desperate attempt to keep Russia and Germany from developing a closer connection, that perhaps Germany would be peeled off, so to speak, from the Western Atlantic Alliance and move somewhat closer to Russia if in the winter the German population began to become extremely uncomfortable with cold weather, et cetera. So I think I'll leave it at that for the moment.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we go to the press, if you have time for that, I want to use your expertise as a nuclear expert, because the situation surrounding the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, as well as other nuclear capacities that Ukraine has, is pretty troubling. And there is sometimes, at least in Russia, a belief that the Ukrainian leadership is using nuclear threat and the threat of nuclear accidents as a bargaining chip, not only with Russia, but even more so with the West. Do you think these explosions at the gas pipelines may change the stance of the Ukrainian authorities, or maybe their understanding of what's permitted and what is not?
Mm-hmm. And when you ask what's permitted and what's not, do you have a specific type of attack in mind?
Well, it's pretty clear that an attack on a gas pipeline is pretty dangerous, not only in terms of ecological impact, but also, you know, thank God nobody has suffered. But if there is a continued shelling on the nuclear station, mm-hmm. the damage could be far more significant. And yet both of these possibilities represent a case of an industrial terrorism.
Yeah. Well, of course, Ukraine is claiming that Russia is shelling the plant.
While Russian forces are being stationed there, right?
Right. Again, I would say I withhold 100% judgment, but I find it rather implausible, the idea that Russia would take over the plant and then shell its own forces and attempt to destroy the power plant, except this destroy the nuclear reactor there. I don't really see what motives there are. Also, I think that it's true that within the Ukrainian forces, there's probably quite a range of players involved. Although groups such as the Azov Battalion or the far right, the quote unquote neo-fascists or whatever names you want to use, certainly far right, highly nationalistic elements, although they've been more fully incorporated into the Ukrainian forces than they used to be, they used to operate to some extent semi-autonomously. I think there's probably still a much wider range of and much less top-down control than there might be. And then I suspect than there is within the Russian forces. Mm-hmm. So I think it's possible that there are either elements within the Ukrainian forces. It could also be something really from central Ukrainian government. So I don't know the details there. I also don't know 100%. It's been years since I focused on some of these issues, whether an attack there could actually initiate a meltdown of the reactor or whether it's simply dispersing radioactive material. Mm-hmm. Either way, it would be a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you something very quickly? And we are running out of time very, very fast. But I don't know if you heard this news, but just a few hours ago, the Ukrainian president, Vladimir Zelensky, called on NATO to strike Russia preventively to neutralize the so-called nuclear threat coming from Russia. And by nuclear threat, I suppose he meant Russia's nuclear capability. That's a statement that was interpreted in Moscow as an invitation to strike Russia's nuclear capacity, Russia's nuclear facilities. What do you think are the chances of the West responding positively to something like that?
I certainly hope not. I would like to believe that sane voices will pertain in the West. Look, Mr. Zelensky is in the middle of a war. He's dealing with what I can only imagine is extraordinary psychological stress and extraordinary pressures from within his own government. The fact that he is in that position and that he perceives himself as the aggrieved party may lead him to make statements that are not at all prudent for anyone, that are not prudent for Ukraine, that are not prudent for the United States, and that are not prudent for Russia. So it is certainly my hope that the U.S. will not take any imprudent actions based on begging, pleading, protestations, or admonitions coming out of Ukraine. Ultimately, the United States exerts control over Ukraine. We sometimes lose trace of that fact. Ukraine makes a statement. We must have HIMARS. We must have long-range HIMARS. We must do X or Y. The United States must acknowledge the simple fact that Ukraine ultimately do whatever the United States wants it to do. That's the simple fact. For better or for worse, that's the way it is. We are not controlled by Mr. Zelensky. Mr. Zelensky ultimately is controlled by us. So there's no way in the world that the U.S. should be acting on every statement that Mr. Zelensky makes, and they certainly should not be acting on statements that could lead to rapid escalation and nuclear war.
Well, let's leave it at that. Thank you very much for your time, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.